Good afternoon, everyone. I know it's 3 o'clock, but there's a lot of pertinent people that haven't joined yet, so maybe we'll give them a couple of minutes.
Hey, Janelle, it's Paul. Sorry about being a few minutes late.
That's okay, no problem. We were actually waiting on a few more people to join because everyone was still getting on. I don't think any of our physicians are on yet. I'm going to give them till 3:05 and then I guess we can get started. Okay, I think we've got a good quorum here, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome for joining. This is our This is going to be our monthly Shack meeting for August. There's a lot of stuff I want to discuss. There was some stuff already on the agenda, but there's a few additional items I'd like to put on the table. So the first thing we want to start off with is, Paul, if you would give us a quick update on what COVID-19 is looking like in our community.
So, Janelle, did you want a PowerPoint? You just want me to verbally tell you what we're seeing out there? How would you like me to proceed?
Well, did I give you the option to share? Because if you have a PowerPoint, you can go ahead and share it.
All right, I can go through it relatively quickly. All right, can you see that?
Yes.
Okay. So a lot of this I presented yesterday at the county commission meeting. I'll go through this pretty quickly. So here's what you see in Alachua. We're over 32,000 cases. Overall, our testing positivity is over 15%. That equates to over 77% of the total population of Alachua County residents being tested since the beginning of this pandemic, which is just an incredible amount of testing that we've done here locally. Last week, surprisingly, our positivity rate dropped from a little over 16% to just under 15%, which was a good sign that perhaps we have plateaued, but it's still too early to tell. Our number of cases per 100,000 went down as well. And that was surprising to me, just given the testing positivity rates that we're seeing here at our DOH testing sites, which were in the mid-20s. So that was good. Here you see the case trends over this year with obviously the peak last week. But again, it looks like at least 1 week, we've got some good news to share. Same thing with the positivity rates. You can see that. I won't spend a lot of time with that. This is right from the School Board of Alachua County dashboard. And you can see the last 14 days, what the students and staff have looked at in terms of the total cases. And Prescott's been doing a great job keeping this up to date. I believe that this was updated as of 9 o'clock last night. And again, I believe that this is weekly cases. So I just wanted to share with you all about the hospitalizations. You can obviously see that perhaps we have plateaued. I'm not sure. This is as of yesterday. It is encouraging to see on the right side that pediatric hospitalizations have relented somewhat. But again, as I shared with the commission yesterday, before June, if we had one pediatric case in the hospitals, that was about the average. Dr. Ryan can speak to that. But when you have, 10 to 14, clearly, relatively speaking, that is a huge increase. In terms of vaccination, and I wasn't able to pull the school vaccination data that Ryan was. I'm still trying to figure that part out. Ryan has left us to go out to the West Coast. But in terms of the eligible population in Alachua County, we have now vaccinated 64% of them. The number of people that we vaccinated last week went down a bit to about 2,700, where we were at about 3,200. So we still have about 85,000 people, 12 and up, who are able to get vaccinated. We started going through the Alachua County schools on Friday, and the uptake with that program, which mirrors the same infrastructure that we use for flu, the uptake hasn't been that great, but I still haven't been able to tease out how many of these kids are going to their pediatrician's offices. So I don't want to take too much away from the low uptake in the first week or so of us going into the schools to offer COVID-19 vaccine in our middle and high schools. And again, just another way to take a look at the data, people vaccinated by week. It did go up a bit over the last 3 weeks, and now it's kind of tapered off. So we continue, collaborating with the Alachua County School Board in terms of testing and contact tracing. Staffing certainly has been an issue. We start off the school year with about, at least from the DOH side, about 50% more nurses than are currently there just due to resignations. It's tough in this environment to keep people on board, just given the number of cases that we've had. I just talked about the vaccine clinics that we'll continue to offer in the schools. So right now, I think that on the DOH side, we have 17 nurses and we're advertising for another 8. Janelli, I don't know how many you're down, but certainly, you know, we're all down nurses. Now, the 17 nurses that I just referenced are above and beyond our regular school nurses who are clearly, you know, overwhelmed at this point. Just wanted to throw this in there. We're open 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. You need an appointment for testing over here, but certainly you don't need an appointment for vaccinations. And we're not only doing this at our main site here on Southeast 24th Street, but also up in our Alachua clinic and also in the SWAG clinic, we have testing and vaccinations as well. I'm not gonna spend a lot of time with this slide. I think that everyone here sees and knows the benefits of getting vaccinated. This is Shan's. This slide is very powerful. Over 90% of the hospitalizations are due to people who are not vaccinated, and North Florida mirrors that as well. So I won't spend a lot of time with that. And then basically that's it. So any questions for me? All right.
Thank you, Paul.
Mr. Marcus, I have a quick question. I'm sorry. I was trying to eat lunch and hide so that you guys didn't know I was snacking. With the University of Florida and Santa Fe starting this week, do you anticipate a significant surge of cases?
The short answer to that question is yes. Time will tell. You know, these students have been in town for, while classes may have just started, the students have been in town for several days, if not weeks before that. But certainly those of you who've been out on the road have seen that the traffic has picked up. And so, yes, I do believe that we will see an increase in cases.
Thank you.
And just to add to that, so we also don't know with the new intern class, this incoming freshman class, not intern, sorry. We don't know how many of them are vaccinated. So with unvaccinated people driving this, then I think we're almost guaranteed an increase in cases with the students returning.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Mott-Young. Okay, next on the agenda, we were going to discuss gaiters and their efficacy. I know Dr. Mott-Young requested that we bring this to the committee to discuss. Dr. Mott-Young, did you want to elaborate on that?
Right, sure, yes. I don't have a whole lot to say about it, but at the time, I think it was something on the table, just looking at the efficacy, making sure that the face coverings that we are having in our schools are safe and are functioning at the most protective capacity that they can. And in looking at some studies, I was sent an article that I thought was really good. It was a study that showed basically, so we know this, the COVID-19 is spread by aerosols. And it what it did was this study tested several different face coverings. It tested the gaiters as well as the traditional face mask versus N95 and a face shield. And all of these things were basically being compared to face shields to see what was the most effective modality at preventing the spread of infection. And I'll just review some of the findings from this study because I think really it solidified at least my comfort level with the gaiters. But basically what it said was, face shields were proposed in the study as an alternative to any of those forms of facial coverings. But what it showed was that for small aerosolized particles, an N95 had about a 99% protection, which we know is the best, but obviously our children can't wear those in the schools. A medical grade facial mask had about 59% protection from aerosolized particles. A single layer gaiter was about 47%, but when you look at a double layer, it had about 60% protection, which is pretty comparable with our traditional face mask covering. So I thought that was reassuring enough because in the COVID response plan for Letcher County, it clearly states it needs to be a double layer gaiter. So as long as that's happening, I think it's protective enough that we can feel confident that that our children or staff that are using these are being provided protection with that. That's all I had about the gators. I don't know if anyone else had any input.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you, Dr. Mott-Young. That's actually reassuring because I was wondering about that. So thank you for giving us those details. Okay, let's see. We're kind of ahead of schedule here, but that's never a bad thing. Next on the agenda, we were going to talk about testing guidelines. And then I'd like to also discuss close contact guidelines. I wanted to give you all kind of a summary of how we are doing our testing here in the schools. So if you will bear with me for just a second, I want to share what our current process is for, let's see. For doing student testing. Can you guys see that?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so this is actually our parent letter that we are sending home with the students when we do testing at the schools. Now, this is mostly geared towards symptomatic students. So I wanted to go through that first and then talk about day 5 testing and how we do that. So here it says, dear parent, guardian of whoever, your child is being sent home because they have exhibited COVID-like symptoms. You agreed to testing provided at the school with signed consent. When it comes to results, your child's rapid tests are positive. Your options are, it used to say here, your child may return to school when one of these is met. But I was wanting to see about changing this wording up here to just say your options are, so that it's just less words. But this is what it said before. It said 10 days have passed since your child got symptoms. This is under what it said before when it said your child may return to school when 10 days have passed since your child got symptoms or a positive test result, and your child has no fever for 24 hours without the use of fever-reducing medication, and their symptoms have improved. Your child may return on day 11, which is blank, and we would write that in there. Now, if their child tested negative at school, we are sending them home because they are showing COVID-19 symptoms, and it is up to them to follow up with a medical provider. Now, their options are, number one, for return to school, your child can return if they receive a negative diagnostic COVID-19 test and have no symptoms. Our question to the committee is, from medical experts and anyone that has input, we are doing the rapid testing, the BinaxNOW now rapid testing. And up until just this week, we have been doing a PCR backup after a negative rapid test. Now, it says it on the insert of the BinaxNOW tests that a PCR backup is required or a rapid test can be redone 36 hours later. We're torn with this because we've seen in the Abbott BinaxNOW press release that it was EUA approved for asymptomatic and symptomatic students. So do we need to send a PCR after a negative rapid test for a symptomatic student?
For a asymptomatic student?
That's symptomatic. What you said, right? Symptomatic.
For a symptomatic student?
Yes.
Okay. So we were, we were just kind of talking, you know, about a few of these things as well. And Paul, if you can hear me, I know there were some shortcomings of the test, or at least having to meet certain criteria. Paul, do you mind saying what those were?
Yeah, so while the Abbott press release does indicate that the test is approved, EUA approved for symptomatic and asymptomatic individuals, the FDA approval letter clearly states that for asymptomatic individuals who are in an environment of high community transmission and or who have been exposed to a confirmed positive COVID-19 individual, that a negative test should be followed up with another test greater than or equal to 36 hours later, and if negative, should be followed up with a PCR. Now, all that said, I can tell you that for the last year or so, we have demonstrated and documented very good concordance with this BINAX test and PCR out in the community, not necessarily with children, but out in the community. We have our sample size is about 1,000, and with very few discrepancies between the two tests. So, you know, I will leave it to Dr. Young and to Dr. Ryan to speak to whether or not for day 5 testing, presumably with these children who are now in quarantine, who we want to get back into school faster, given that the PCR test on day 5 doesn't really gain us any time because of the turnaround time of 2 to 3 days. If the kid was just to have the no test option, could go back on day 8 anyway. If this committee wanted to evaluate over, say, 2 or 3 weeks of doing day 5 PCR, at the same time doing a rapid test so that we could document that concordance moving forward. Okay, so I think that's the proposal on the table. Is it for a certain amount of time, do we want to do both, which has its advantages and disadvantages? So I'll leave it there just to see if Dr. Young and Dr. Ryan have a different take on that.
So the benefit with doing that, obviously, is over this period of time, once we obtain enough samples to have 10 positives or 20 positives, we would be able to say whether this BINAX test is accurate enough to continue to do that alone, and we can trust the information we're getting from it. So I think it's reasonable. It'd be good to hear everyone else's input on it, but I think it's reasonable to do. It would need to be communicated clearly to the parents so that they're aware, but I would think that a lot of parents would feel, I think they would actually feel good to know that their child is getting a confirmatory PCR as well, along with their rapid test, to confirm that they are truly negative or actually positive.
Well, I think I was talking about symptomatic students, and mm-hmm. Paul is talking about asymptomatic students. So
right.
Can you differentiate those two when it comes to the PCR?
So yes, the symptomatic students are those who are presenting to your school clinics, right, on day 0. Because they're sick. They're being sent home anyway.
Right.
So I would, if it were me, I would do a PCR test on these kids. I mean, I'm sorry. I would do a rapid test on these kids, because if they're positive, they go home anyway. If they're negative, they go home anyway, but you're following it up with a PCR. So I'm sorry if I confuse the day 5 testing with the rapid to replace the PCR that we're doing right now. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Yeah, so these kids are going to need to get medical clearance to return likely anyway. So hopefully they can get a PCR from their doctor for symptomatic kids. So I feel like it would be different when you're talking about them.
So, okay. A student presents to our school clinic symptomatic. We do a BINAX rapid test on them. They're negative. Mm-hmm. Do we follow that up with a PCR right there? Or do we send them home?
Both.
Both, yeah. You can follow that up with the PCR right there.
Could or should?
You should. You should follow it up with the PCR at that time.
So, okay. Now, what about for the day 5 testing for the asymptomatic?
Right. So for the asymptomatic child, obviously, if they're positive, they're not going to be coming. They're gonna not going to stay at school. But if they're negative, so what we're putting on the table here is to do a confirmation. Well, PCR, follow up with the PCR at the same time as the rapid. Okay, just so we can have some data to correlate to make sure that the rapid tests are accurate enough for us to just rely solely upon those.
Okay, and you wanted us to do that like 10 students as a trial and see if that works, 10, 20?
No, it's going to need to be more than that. I think we're going to need to probably get around 300 tests. But considering how many students were testing, and that's something I wanted to ask you, Janelle, and anybody else on the call, it sounds like we're testing a lot of students, at least from what we've started within the past couple of days here with the rapid test. So it probably won't take as long as it sounds. This may even be able to be done within a couple weeks.
So if we're then backing it up with a PCR for the day 5 testing, mm-hmm. if they get a negative rapid at the day 5 testing at school, can they go to school?
Yes, they can return to school. Okay, that's with the caveat. They can return to school, okay. But also the parent will be informed, and that should be within the consent, that they will be having the PCR. It's a chance it could return positive. If that happens, the child would have to leave school again and go back into isolation or go into isolation at that point.
Can I ask a question?
Sure. Yes.
Just so I can clarify. So if a child is asymptomatic and they're getting tested at school for whatever reason, contact tracing or whatever, asymptomatic, and the rapid test, the BINAX is negative, what happens after that to that child?
So at the same time, they also get a PCR. So that PCR will have back within 2 to 3 days. And if that PCR comes back as negative, then we can trust that that rapid test was accurate. If it comes back as positive, then that child has to go in isolation. If they're asymptomatic, it'll be from the date of the positive test.
Okay. And so for those 2 and 3 days in between, for an asymptomatic negative rapid test child, they have to be at home?
No, they're at school.
Oh, okay.
Yes, they're at school. And this is all with everyone has a common goal. We all want these children to get back in school as soon as possible. But sure. We need to feel confident that this rapid test is accurate.
Yep.
And this would be a test, a way for us to be able to measure that and have some data to stand on.
Mm-hmm. Janelle, were you going to say how many tests you guys are doing? I think that's what Dr. Mott was.
So I went to Parker Elementary this morning and we did 25 tests. Out of those, we had one positive. The rest of them went back to school. They came with their backpacks and they just walked right into school because they were negative. After the test processed, of course. We have more coming up on Friday. I know that some schools are doing them themselves. I know that Mabane did 10, and I know that some other schools have done them. I can't remember off the top of my head, but the largest group so far has been at Parker where we did 25. This morning, and I was there, and we had some help. We had UF graduate students from the epidemiology department that came and helped, and that was it flowed. It went great. I have another school who's got a group of 40 scheduled to do day 5 testing on Monday. So I'm definitely going to be recruiting help for that. So that's going to double our time to do a rapid and the PCR at the same time. I mean, that would take off 40 of the 300 that you're proposing. But as long as those kids can go back to school, if they're negative, I think that's a good deal. I know we did this at Camp Crystal over the summer, and those were all asymptomatic students, and we did not follow them up with a PCR. We did catch a couple of positives. I know I was personally there doing the testing, and it seemed pretty effective, and I did not hear of all the cases that were sent home. I wasn't followed up on every single student, but I know that it flowed well when we did it there. And we didn't back those up with PCRs.
So Janelle, on this form where you say your options are, could instead you just say return to school?
Instead of saying your options are, say return to school if?
Yeah, 10 days have passed, your child has, or, you know.
Right, it just, I changed the top part because it did say that, and I changed the part where it said your options are, and I was going to go back later and change it to where it actually flows correctly. But, I mean, if we like the wording how it is now, we can put it back to your child.
Yeah, the wording, it sounds fine. I just, I don't know that I like that your options are.
Right. So I thought of that because we get a lot of phone calls from parents and even teachers and administrators even, who will call me and say, I'm reading this letter and I'm kind of confused because I can't really tell what my options are.
Mm.
So then I go through the list and I tell them, these are your options. And then they say, oh, okay, I get it now. These are my options. So that's why I kind of wanted to change.
Okay.
So.
Or you could say, return to school and then your options are.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Put return to school as taught.
That whole second portion has to do with when to return to school.
Gotcha. Yes.
I was just going to add, I think one of the challenges this year is that, you know, last year with our day three and day nine testing, we eventually got in a routine. People became more, you know, understood what the different timelines were. With the new emergency rules, there was kind of a change in the timeline, which is good because that lets us have our students back in school earlier. But that means we kind of have to get everyone back on the same page with what those days are.
Okay, so we've agreed that we're going to require the PCR test here if they receive a negative rapid and they're symptomatic. And also, we're going to do the PCR with the rapid for day five testing for temporarily, just to confirm that that rapid test is, in fact, accurate. Gotcha.
If they're negative.
So if they're positive on that day five, we don't have to do a PCR. Or for if they are symptomatic.
Right.
Right.
So for number one, should it say something about giving the PCR? Because if they're negative, we're following up with a PCR in the clinic now too. And they'll have to go home until the results because these are symptomatic.
That's for symptomatic.
Yes, this is symptomatic kids. They had COVID-like symptoms in school and the parent consented to testing. And it's either going to be positive, that's a no-brainer, but if they're negative, are we going to follow up that negative? It's a symptomatic kid with a PCR and those parents will be told, you know, you can't send your kid back until we get those results and your child has no symptoms.
Right. I mean, that's my understanding of it. And I think that's what makes sense. Obviously, the child can't return even if the test is negative. If they're symptomatic, they need to have improved their symptoms at least before they can return. But yes, we need to take the time to get a PCR test to confirm that that child is negative before they can come back for a symptomatic child.
Okay, the executive order for protocol for symptomatic children, it says the student receives a negative diagnostic COVID-19 test and is asymptomatic, or those other two choices. So it specifically kind of says receives a negative diagnostic COVID test and has no symptoms. But if we're going to throw in a PCR in here and parent has to keep the student home, we're kind of veering off the executive order. So I just want to make sure that that's what, you know, we're going to do. This letter would have to be tweaked to say that specifically.
Yes, it would. Yeah.
Because a parent could argue that this negative diagnostic test is the rapid that they received in the clinic from the school nurse. And hey, my kid has no symptoms. You know, this was done on Monday, but Tuesday, my kid has no symptoms. And your test yesterday said it was negative, so my kid can come back.
Oh, you're talking about for a symptomatic child that now has no symptoms and wants to return to school.
Right. And they could argue that, well, yesterday you gave me a rapid in the clinic and it was negative and I don't have any symptoms today, so I should be allowed to come back.
So in that situation, I think it kind of goes back to the option of them having to have a medical provider to clear them to return. Because at that point we have a PCR pending, we don't know for a fact this child is negative and that we can allow them to return at that point. So if they have a medical provider clear them to return, then that's okay, but we still have a PCR pending. As a parent knows that if that returns positive, that child will have to leave school.
Well, we might not have a PCR pending because they may consent to the rapid, but not the PCR. Or the child might not let us follow through with the PCR.
Right.
So
right.
That's what I'm just playing devil's advocate of what a parent may argue.
That form there, could we write under number one in the bottom, your child receives a negative diagnostic COVID-19 test by a medical provider and has no symptoms.
So we're going to go off the executive order then that the notice of emergency rule that the Department of Health put out in the Department of Education.
So what I think we're going to have to do is there's more than one set of rules that we have to navigate. So it has to be that there are Department of Health emergency rules and those say a negative diagnostic test, but we have to also follow the specifications for the test that we're using. So that BINACS test, it has specific ways that you are supposed to use it, and it gives you guidance on how to interpret those results. So some of that guidance, it does say that, you know, you're looking at the totality of the situation of, you know, the context of did they have symptoms, do they not? I wouldn't say we have to align with both the emergency rules. So we are using a diagnostic test. We also make sure have to use the test as intended. So there is the CMS, which kind of oversees the testing waiver that we're using. They have said that they are going to have enforcement discretion during the public health emergency so that they're allowing that that asymptomatic testing for the asymptomatic. So they're
I'm not even speaking about the asymptomatic day five. This is specifically kids that present to the clinic with COVID-like symptoms.
So what I was hearing is that during this period, we're going to offer both tests and then use the results to determine if that is a sustainable thing to use just the rapid tests.
That's for day five. But Janelle has a whole different, this is testing at school for COVID-like symptoms.
Are you currently requiring a symptomatic child to have a letter to return back to school, or what are you currently telling them? If they're COVID negative, are you saying you have to go see your doctor before you can return to school, or as long as your symptoms are resolved, you can return to school?
I can show you our letter that we're sending so you can see exactly what we're telling them. For symptomatic, I'm sorry, is that what you said?
Symptomatic, yes.
Oh, that was the same letter, yes. Our other letters are for close contact. So this is assuming this is a symptomatic student. So, I'm sorry, I stopped sharing. I'll share it again.
So are we going to say that, so for that number one, maybe we can just change the wording so it's a little bit more clear, because to me that is unclear. So your child received a negative diagnostic COVID-19 test. So they were negative at school, okay, by the rapid test. And what did you guys say about doing the backup PCRs? We're doing them or not doing them?
We were thinking, and we're talking, Dr. Ryan, so, I mean, if you don't think we should, but what we're saying is that we would have them to be able to consent to do a backup PCR to confirm that they're truly negative.
Right. So your child received a negative diagnostic test, COVID-19 test, and now has no symptoms or has become asymptomatic, because they were obviously symptomatic or they wouldn't be getting this form to start with. They had some sort of symptoms. So if you had a negative test and now you have no symptoms, I think we should still be doing the PCR backup on the symptomatic kids.
Right, and they technically couldn't return to school until they get that
result
back. Yeah.
And they have to be symptom free for 20, you know, well, improvement of symptoms.
So it should, number one, should say your child receives a negative PCR or diagnostic PCR COVID test and has no symptoms. That's when they can return. Correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they can return. And I think in a lot of ways it will save the families a visit to the doctor or to the health department to have to get the PCR. It can just be done before they leave school.
Yeah. And then, so number two should say, or 10 days have passed since your child tested positive and was symptomatic, because those are the kids who test positive, and now that's your period of isolation.
Well, this is symptomatic kids. So the executive order says 10 days have passed since the onset of symptoms or positive test result.
Right.
So we could make it say exactly what the executive order says.
Right. That's what I would say.
Yeah. But it then says the same thing. And your child has no fever and their symptoms have improved. So we could add in that portion. But that's onset of symptoms. So this child's symptomatic. They can't come back for 10 days.
Right.
Since their symptoms started.
And their test, and or their test was, you know.
Or if they test positive.
So from the school standpoint, if their symptoms started the day before they were tested at school, they shouldn't have come to school that day anyway. But that doesn't mean they might not.
So
the last one I was going to say, it looks fine. I probably would add in, and it's just semantics, but physician assistant as well. We do have physician assistants, and every time I see that, I realize it doesn't say that.
Okay. I think we got that cleared up. Thank you for your input on that, because we were still kind of back and forth on the PCR and the rapid and all of that. So thank you.
And I think Paul had mentioned having a consent form already, or at least an outline of one to use for the coupling of the rapid antigen and the PCR for the period of time that we'll be doing it.
The consent form that I have in my hand, it says, I understand that my child may be tested as often as determined necessary by an authorized medical provider or public health official. So I'm guessing this is the one that y'all are using.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we assume that it covered both of them. So
is that consent form good for the whole year, or
it was just updated for this year? Yes.
Okay. Okay. So the parent just has to sign one time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
the problem arises when they consent to the rapid, and then we tell them that we need to do the PCR as well, and then they refuse the PCR.
Or so the rapid is negative, then 3 days later, the PCR is positive, and they're yanked back out of school.
All right, so I think we're good there.
And I feel like some parents are gonna, that will be hard to explain. I feel like that could be a potentially hard discussion that they had a negative test and now it's positive, and then they now have to go back home. So yeah, it would be difficult to explain, but again, I they have to realize that that's a risk, but it's in an effort to help us get the best information so we can make sure we're testing everybody in the most accurate way that we can. But that has to be continuously communicated to people, and they have to understand that that's a risk when we're testing them both ways.
And is the point, just one more question, is the point of all of this, or at least part of it, in trying to get to the 300 number or whatever, to be able to not do PCR for asymptomatic? Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes, that's the point.
That's the point. Mm-hmm. Because if the rapid is reliable enough, then we wouldn't do the PCR. We would just do the rapid and go with those results.
Thank you.
And let me just add in, we have a sample size in Alachua County that has very good concurrence with the rapid and the PCR. And the sample size is close to 1,000. In addition to that, when you talk to, and Dr. Ryan and Dr. Young, please correct me if I'm wrong, but when you're in an environment of high disease transmission, we're much more comfortable with the predictive value of the rapid test than if we were in an environment with low disease transmission. And right now, we're in an environment of very high disease transmission.
And other pediatric practices in town have also looked at the concordance between day 4 or 5 rapid test testing and PCRs and found very high concordance at that time. So we should be okay, but we have not tested it in the school system. So that's why we want to be as scientifically sound as we can.
Right. And at some point later, when our disease transmission, our community transmission rates are lower, we would have to repeat this for this couple week period just to compare those variables. So parents would need to know that too, that in the near future, this will come back around just for a brief period of time.
Sounds good. Thank you. Okay, the last item on the agenda is vaccinations. Oh, wait, did we discuss household contacts?
I don't think so.
No, we didn't just, I'm sorry. We missed the household contacts. And I don't really think there's a need to really discuss it yet anymore. I think we came to the conclusion, and we have on one of our letters stating, and I'll show you again, household contacts. Is this the correct one, Melissa? Because I thought on one of them it said that if they have been vaccinated. Oh, yes. Your child may stay in school if they're a household contact after meeting one of the following exceptions. Your child has no symptoms and is fully vaccinated for COVID-19. Fully vaccinated means that the exposure was at least 14 days after the COVID-19 series. Or your child has no symptoms and has had COVID-19 in the last 90 days. So we did implement that where if it is a household contact, but they have been vaccinated or they've had it in the last 90 days, that they are exempt from quarantine. Do we agree? Do we all agree that that's okay?
As long as they're asymptomatic.
As long as they're asymptomatic, okay. Okay, so back to the agenda. Vaccinations. I know that the health department is going to be providing vaccinations for our students, and they've already started the process, which is great. this is a hard topic to discuss, but I think it needs to be at least considered, is because Pfizer is now FDA approved, when will we move towards mandating it? Especially for employees. What is your...
Well, Dr. Ryan, were you about to say something? Oh, no. Okay.
And we also, if you want to just ponder that for a while, we also wanted to talk about how to best promote it in the schools for these students, because we still do not have very much acceptance. So we would like to come up with some better ideas of how to promote it more in the schools.
Is the incentive working? Does it seem to be?
Doesn't seem to be.
Doesn't seem to be working too well.
No. I know we've got incentives for the employees as far as if you're vaccinated, you get a $100 bonus. We've also got, we're at the point where COVID leave is allotted for those that are vaccinated. But if they're not vaccinated, they do not get that COVID leave if they test positive. For students, there's not really any incentive right now.
I mean, that's a hard one. So I feel like eventually it's going to be mandatory, not just in the schools, everywhere. You know, I feel like for many different places, that's just going to become the normal, a common thing. The question as of when that needs to happen, when that can happen, I don't know. I mean, logistically wise, or not even logistically speaking, but it would seem that we would already be at that point, obviously, with the numbers, with the positivity rate being at the level at which it has been, what this has put on our community, our world, and the burdens that it has placed, it would seem that we would already be there. But I can't answer that. I'm not entirely sure when we need to enact that, but I think it needs to be in the works.
I agree. I don't know that we can, just like the University of Florida was a state institution, the schools are governed by the state. I don't think we can do that independently, unfortunately. A private institution, a private college, a private business, they can do that anytime they want. They can make it mandatory. But I think we have to, are under different rules. And so we have to abide by state guidelines, et cetera, for those kind of things. I wish we didn't have to, but we're going to have to. I did hear a teacher say this morning at GHS when I was there at the vaccine clinic for a while, who was getting his first one. Can I get my $100 now? So, and they were like, after you're fully vaccinated, you can get your.
Maybe they are thinking about it.
Right. Maybe they are thinking about it.
I think once we have that data from the health department about our vaccination rates, then we'll be able to have kind of a more informed conversation. Because we may not be in the place where, you know, that's a discussion about requiring it, because we have had high interest, among our staff. But we just don't have the exact number for that yet. So we might not even need to be in that place right now. And ultimately, that would be the board decision looking for this group's recommendations. But that would have to be something that they would discuss and come to an agreement on.
One of the things that Shans did was. In the past, the beginning of last week, was for any staff member that was not vaccinated, if they were working in any of the clinical areas, they were unvaccinated, they had to wear an N95 the whole time they were working. So that spurred along quite a few people, because wearing an N95 for 8 or 10 hours a day is not fun.
And some people have said they've done frequent testing, like weekly testing, if they're not vaccinated.
Right. Those are the kind of things we can do.
A separate question, I know, so Paul, if he's still on the call too, if in the meantime, until that conversation is able to be had in a more meaningful way, are we getting something out to school staff and any students who are eligible? Because I'm not sure on the age for the monoclonal antibody site that just recently opened this week in High Springs as an early treatment, you know, so that we can help people stay out of the hospital and stuff. Are we able to get that out through the school system so that they can be knowledgeable of it?
The antibody treatment sites?
Say that again.
The antibody treatment sites?
Right.
So the information on that has gone out to all the medical providers in Alachua County. It has gone out. It's on the county's social media, on the county's media. The county's press release. So the information is out there, and it's my understanding, Lauren, that it's for 12 and up. I might be mistaken on that. So it's either a referral by your PCP, which all the ones in the county should have that information now, or obviously if you're of age, you can self-register. So I know that yesterday they did 64. Today they are doing over 80. So the information's out there, and they have the capacity to do over 300 a day.
That's good. I didn't know if Dr. Mott Young or someone else or Janelli knew if this is out there for staff so that they know that there's, you know, something available, whatever their vaccination status is.
I have not seen anything come across my inbox or anything about that. So
it's something we can certainly push out through Jackie Johnson for sure.
Sure.
So from an age standpoint, it's for children, it's 12 years and 40 kilos. So they have to meet both the age and the weight requirement in order to be able to get it. So for them, it's probably better for them to have some sort of referral from a physician. But for consenting adults, they can refer themselves. They don't require a doctor's order.
Just out of curiosity, does anybody know, is this a pay out of pocket? Is it an insurance? Does your insurance cover this?
There's no out of pocket to the patient. If insurance can be billed, it will. It will be.
Okay. Yeah.
I know you have to reach certain criteria to be able to qualify for it, though, because some people are being turned away in High Springs already because they didn't meet the standards.
So the guidelines say that you have to be symptomatic and at high risk for progression. And then there's a whole list of things that are high risk for progression. When I looked at the state order, it also said that people that were exposed and at high risk for progression.
Dr. Ryan, is there a time frame on it?
Yeah, you're right. And I was just putting something in the chat box. I have to drop off because I have a 4 o'clock. So appreciate the opportunity. Please contact me if you have any questions or concerns. I'm happy to continue to support the school system any way we possibly can. And I hope to see a better vaccine uptake at the clinics coming up. So again, y'all know how to get a hold of me.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. Bye. Bye. So were we finished talking about that? I'm sorry. I didn't want to talk about something else if we weren't.
I just thought Dr. Ryan might have it in front of her. There was a certain time frame that you had to fall into or you're turned away. That's what some of the people in High Springs have told me. They were turned away because they were past the time frame.
I have to go back. I have to go back and read. I think it's within 5 days of symptoms or within 10 days of symptoms.
Right. Something like that.
But one of the high risk conditions is hypertension. So some of them are more serious, like immune compromised, you know, but others are less. But they don't have to be very serious to get the treatment.
Okay.
Yes. I also did want to ask if anyone has any suggestions. So I've heard it mentioned several times about parents bringing their children to school, even if there's someone that's COVID positive in the household. I understand some of that is education, just making sure people are aware that that's not appropriate. But does anyone have any recommendations on how we can help educate people about that and help them really stick to the guidelines here so that way we're not spreading this further in our schools?
So Jackie Johnson put out an email and I think she's done it multiple times this year already, and it's only been 3 weeks, to remind parents to please, if they are having symptoms, to stay home. If they've been tested and awaiting results, to stay home. If there's someone COVID positive in the home, to stay home. I mean, I think she just put that out again, either early today or yesterday, I can't remember. But as a parent, I get all these notices. So I know for sure two have already been sent out this year.
Okay.
You know, I think a lot of it could be that we have a lot of families that are not English speaking. And they get this information, but they don't understand it. And their kids don't relay it to them, even if they speak English. So, I mean, we had a family at the beginning of the year, or maybe it was the end of last year, where they were all Spanish speaking. No one spoke English. The dad tested positive, but all the kids were coming to school. And the information had been given, but the parents didn't understand it. So I think that might be an issue, is the language barrier. So I don't know how we can.
Is it possible to get those announcements that Jackie's putting out in both English and Spanish?
We would have to talk to Jackie about figuring that out.
So at least, since that would be the one language that would probably be most common. Of course, there's going to be other languages that people could have a barrier with English with, but at least Spanish is probably the biggest one. At least that would cut down on some of that.
I think the education needs to come from the parents' PCP as well. I think the pediatricians are doing a really good job at asking about siblings and telling the parent that siblings also need to stay out until X, Y, and Z. But I think if the adult PCPs could also kind of ask that question to their COVID positive patient, do you have any kids at home? They're going to need to quarantine. Don't send them to school. Call the school nurse and she'll give you the dates or something like that. I think it needs to come from that end as well.
Very good point.
Okay, so I know this sounds like a lot of testing. We've mentioned adding on the PCRs at least for a little while, but also something to look at in order to better track the spread of this virus within our schools, because we want to have the best grasp upon it as we can to understand how quickly it's spreading, what the rates are, trying to keep these as low as possible, ideally. But something called routine surveillance. So parents would have to consent to this, but periodically checking a certain number of students, doing a test on them just to kind of see right then and there in asymptomatic kids, how many are testing positive at different times. So that's something to think about instituting as well throughout the school year.
That's something we would have to talk to Dr. Simon and the board about.
Okay. But I think the more information we have, then the better we're able to maybe, you know, when we're looking at these mitigation strategies, the more information we have as far as what the actual problem is and what the numbers look like, then we can make a better informed decision based upon those things. So, but yes, I will be happy to discuss it with Dr. Simon.
I'm guessing that would have to change the parental consent as well.
It would.
When we talked earlier this week about that, I would probably have to be a separate consent for surveillance testing. Mm-hmm. Dr. Simon was looking into it.
Okay, so she's already aware. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
I'm going to have to jump off also. I have another meeting, so.
That's fine. I appreciate all of you taking your time this afternoon. And we will continue moving forward. And I thank you all for your input.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.